everybody. I'm Carolyn Waters, the head librarian, and I want to welcome you all to the New York Society Library. And if you haven't already done so, please silence your cell phones or anything that might disrupt the presentation. Now, I am not only the head librarian. Since I started at the library full time in 2008, I've also been honored to be officially called the Writer Services Librarian here. It's an unofficial title. And with the extraordinary support from Jenny Lawrence, we have been able to provide a diverse range of programming by and for writers. So we are incredibly grateful for Jenny's ongoing commitment to writers, and we're thankful to all of you who contribute to our annual fund. Now, it gives me great pleasure now to introduce our panelists tonight and our moderator. And I thought, since you're all capable of reading the books and your program, that there was no sense for me reading that I would give you a little introduction to how the library came to know these fine writers, because they're interesting stories of all. So, Julia Johnson, right here on my right, who lives in LA, is our West Coast distributor of tote bags and our propaganda machine on the West Coast. She's been known to refuse friendships to New Yorkers, unless they join the New York Society Libraries. It's true. You think I'm kidding. I'm not. We actually did come to know Julia through our Arcana tote bags, which Katie is selling out there if anybody is dying to have one. I don't know whether you lost one or gave it away, but she was desperate for a new tote bag and emailed us, and a friendship was born. So, in fact, by the way, that email correspondence could probably be I was thinking it might make a good comic sketch, but anyway, her novel Be Frank With Me is really as charming and funny as she is, and it is one of the most heartfelt portrayals of a young boy on the spectrum that I think you'll ever read. So I encourage you to read her book and all of their books. Jonathan Putnam, right next to Julia, is an acclaimed trial attorney turned writer. And as a former, as a career changer slash, corporate quitter myself, I actually felt a really strong bond with Jonathan when I met him. Now, our members are our best salespeople, and actually, there was a lovely couple that introduced us at Jonathan's father's talk at the library, because Jonathan does come from a family of writers, and they introduced me to him and convinced him to join the library. He, in fact, did join the library not long after that conversation, started attending some of our Writing Life programming, joined one of our fiction writing groups, and now we are so pleased to say that at the infancy of this fantastic page-turning historical suspenseful mystery, These Honored Dead, we were there at the beginning of that. So, and if you all enjoy the book as much as I did, which I'm sure you will, I understand now that you can actually pre-order the second book in the Lincoln Speed Mystery Series because Jonathan sold it in a 3-book deal, so kudos to you. When I met Imbola Mavoy, she was actually introduced to me by the name Julia, interestingly enough, which I just learned today is actually her given name. So the fact that she decided to drop the Julia and stick with Imbola makes it easier now that we have
two.
Yes. I have the privilege of emceeing a group of periodic readings of a small group of aspiring writers here on the Upper East Side. And honestly, despite my mediocrity at the job, they keep inviting me back. I can't explain it. But on one of these evenings, Imbola was invited to read. And I think I can say for everybody who was in the room that night, it was really obvious that we had a major talent in the room, and we were really blown away. It was only much later that we heard that her debut novel had been sold and that it had caused this great literary sensation. But we had to wait nearly 3 years from the point, I think, that we met you that night for this really remarkable novel, Behold the Dreamers, to make its way into the world. And our moderator tonight is Lauren Belfer. Now, Lauren's own highly acclaimed first novel, City of Light, was published in 1999, and Lauren has actually been a member of the New York Society Library for 32 years. I looked it up. So when I was casting about for moderators for the panel, what I was looking for was somebody whose own first novel was a bestseller, and that someone who had gone on then to have future success with their subsequent books. And I don't know how, I don't know how Lauren has eluded my grasp all these years, because those of you that are members of the library and are writers know that, like, I latch on, like, you know. But I realize that you had spoken here at the library. You were in conversation with the author, Beth Butchin, on a panel, in a conversation called Friendship, Family, and Betrayal in Fiction. And you can actually find that video on our website, so you should look at it, because it's really great. In any case, I was casting about for this, you know, this moderator, and I happened to spy Lauren's book in a bookstore. And I will say that her latest book, And After the Fire, which is her third novel, is this amazing story with an extraordinary cast of characters. And I thought, aha, she's our moderator. So I'm just grateful that you have agreed to participate and take on this job. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Lauren Belfer, Ngola Mbuwe, Jonathan Putnam, and Julia Claiborne Johnson.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. Can everyone hear me? And thank you also, Sarah, and thank you to the entire staff of the New York Society Library. It's such a privilege and an honor to be here at the library. If you're not a member of the library, I hope you'll all become members. This is one of the great treasures of New York City. And one of the things that makes it so extraordinary is the fact that the stacks are open here. And as I did the research for all three of my books here, and to be able to just wander through the stacks makes a tremendous difference in your work. And in fact, for City of Light, the most important research book that I found for that novel was the book next to the book that I had gone down to look for, and I never would have found that. I had no idea that this book existed. How would I ever have looked it up? And there it was, next to the book that I went to find. So I hope that you will all support this library and its many programs. And again, thank you, Carolyn, for making this evening possible for us. I'd like to start by asking each of our panelists to go back and talk about their lives before their debut novels, to talk about how and when they decided that they wanted to be writers and then got their training. And this evening is about them, of course, but I'll just say a few words about my own past, that I decided to become a fiction writer when I was 6 years old. I have no idea why. Just one day seemed like the best thing I could possibly do. My early work, was crayoning stories about heroic pets and about princesses who led their nations to victory in battle, some of them with heroic pets. Then by the time I was in high school, I was receiving rejection letters from my work from all the best publications around the country. The first short story I ever published was rejected 42 times before I found an editor who loved it. This was before the days of self-publishing. With this, my second short story to be published, I was much more successful. It was only rejected 27 times. So it just shows that writing can be a very long road. And persistence, it seems to me, is the most important factor in becoming a writer. I know there are a lot of hopeful writers in this room, so I will just say that you just have to keep at it, rejection after rejection. So I would really like to hear your stories of those early days, and we'll start alphabetically. So Mbola, why don't you begin?
Hi everybody. Thank you, Lori. So my story, I'm from Cameroon, in Central Africa, and I grew up reading books a lot, but I never thought that there's such a thing as being a writer. I didn't know anybody who was a writer. I never met writers. I didn't even consider that the people who wrote these books were actually men and women. Who was Charles Dickens? Who was Shakespeare? Were they people? I don't know. I never thought about that, the people behind this book. I just knew that they were books. And that is how I thought of books and writing until I came to America. I came here for college. I was 17. And then after college, I found myself living in a town called Falls Church, Virginia. I didn't know anybody in this town. I went there because I had a job somewhere around there. So that is how I got into writing, through an act of serendipity. I wasn't thinking anything about writing. I never considered writing until I walked into a library in Falls Church, Virginia, and I saw a book by Toni Morrison called Song of Solomon. And I was I didn't know much about Toni Morrison except that she won the Nobel Prize in Literature a few years before. So I borrowed this book and I went back home thinking it's going to be some kind of religious book, because there's a book in the Bible called Song of Solomon. And then I went home and I read this book and I was blown away by how powerful it was. And I just started writing the moment I finished reading this book. I didn't think much about what I'll do with my writing. I just thought, wow, you know, this is amazing that you can write and this woman wrote this book, and how wonderful it would be to write something. And I just started writing the story about an African girl in a fictional African country. I had no plans for what to do with that writing. I wrote for myself, I wrote for my own enjoyment, and that was it. And I kept on writing for 9 years. And during this time, I moved back to New York City. I went to Columbia, got a master's in education. I was going to get a PhD, but that plan didn't work out. And then I ended up working in corporate America, and I lost that job. So this whole time, I'm still writing until I lost my corporate job, and then I got the idea to write the novel Behold the Dreamers. And it was only around then, 2011, after I'd been writing for 9 years, that somebody I know met an agent, met an agent's friend, and told the agent's friend that, like, oh, I know somebody who writes. And the agent's friend said, oh, why don't you have her send her work to this, to my friend, this agent, who is a really big agent. So why don't you have her send her work to my friend? So I sent my work to this agent, and she read it, and she said, you have tremendous potential, keep writing. And that was the first time I started thinking that I could get my work published. And then that was basically when I started thinking, I'm going to try to finish this book and have it published.
So I spent almost all my time in college writing for the school daily newspaper and not going to class. And I was actually writing sports. I was confident I was going to become a sports writer. And then about my senior year, I chickened out of that plan. Mainly I blamed L.A. Law. I'm not sure if people remember the TV show L.A. Law, but that was the heyday of L.A. Law. And every Thursday night, I would get a pint of Ben & Jerry's ice cream, you know, and eat it. Those were the days. And watch L.A. Law, and that was such a pleasurable feedback loop that somehow I got the idea that going to law school and becoming a lawyer would be like watching L.A. Law and eating ice cream every day. So I went to law school, and time passed. And so I was a lawyer, a trial lawyer for a big law firm here in Manhattan for 25 years. But writing had always been the path not taken for me. And I got to a point in my career where I had, you know, had some success doing that, and I just wasn't sure whether I wanted to do it for the next 20 or 25 years. So starting in about 2006, I tried to write while still being a lawyer. Scott Turow, for example, is a famous writer, a lawyer turned writer, who wrote his Break the Book, Presumed Innocent, on the train famously commuting from the Chicago suburbs to the Loop. So I commuted on a train from the New York City suburbs to New York. So I said, okay, if Scott Turow can do it, you know, why can't I? And I spent 5 years trying to do that. I didn't want to, you know, give up the income if I didn't have to, candidly, and made zero progress. I literally wrote about 5 pages in 5 years. I mean, part of it was sort of a, there's only so many hours in the day problem, but it was more like a bandwidth problem. I just couldn't find the mental energy to be creative at the same time I had a busy law job. And so I got to the point where I realized that if I was ever gonna explore this path not taken, I just had to jump in with both feet and not, and sort of throw in the bridges and not do it half-heartedly. So I went in and quit my, resigned from my partnership, from my law partnership, had the great good fortune to meet Carolyn Waters, I think that week. Mm-hmm. And because I had quit and then had no idea what, you know, what does that mean? Where do I go? How do I do this? The very first day that I was no longer a lawyer, the day that my resignation took effect, I wrote 7 pages. Now, in retrospect, they weren't good 7 pages, but it was, you can't get anything done if you don't start writing. And for whatever reason, formally taking off my lawyer hat allowed me to start putting on my writer hat. And it was 5.5 years of a lot of work with great friends that are in the audience here as part of a writing group that Carolyn arranged through the library. It was 5.5 years from the day that I actually started writing in earnest to when my book came out a month ago.
Wow. Well, I grew up on a farm in Tennessee, which was not very glamorous. So I was like, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to milk cows every day. And so I went to college, and my father was one of those guys who told stories, and he told a story, and whether it was factual had very little to do with the course of the story. He never let the truth get in the way of a good story, which is an excellent person to grow up with as a parent if you're going to write fiction. So I got the early training, and I went to college, and then I moved to New York City, and I got a job working at Mademoiselle Magazine. I was the assistant to the fiction editor, and I was the person who read the 10,000 manuscripts that came in every year as short story submissions. And because of that, and it was hard to find 12 to publish, it was just hard. And I realized in the course of that, not everybody's cut out to be a writer, and it's really hard. And the ability to write a good sentence doesn't mean you can write a good novel. And I didn't feel like my soul had things in it that were dying to be unleashed for the world, that they were waiting for just,
when is she gonna write a book?
And so many years passed, and I had children, and you know, and then I was rereading a lot of the books I read when I was 13. And I read To Kill a Mockingbird. And I was walking down my block, and I was thinking about Boo Radley. And I don't know about you guys, but I found raising children very, like, a little harder than I thought it was going to be. Every morning on the farm, like, they would open the back door, and I would just disappear onto the farm, and then I'd come home at night. So they didn't pay a lot of attention to me, and that turned out fine, but apparently that doesn't really always work these days. So, but anyway, I was thinking about Boo Radley, and my kids were in public school, and so you see all kinds of kids that way. So I thought, oh, Boo Radley must be on the autism spectrum. And it had never occurred to me. I was like, oh, well, you know, that character has always been in fiction. People just didn't know what it was. And so then my very next thought, because I had 2 children, was, well, it's a lot easier to write that character than it is to raise him. And then the whole book exposed itself to me. And I was just like, oh my God. So that's not really how it turned out to be. I guess it is how it turned out to be a writer, because I never felt like I needed to write a novel, but I thought that would be such a fun novel to read, and it didn't exist. And I thought, I would like to read that novel. I guess I'll have to write that novel in order to read it. And I've read it way too many times. Yeah. It's like these guys in the course, it took me 5 years to write it. You can't imagine how many times you have to read it over and over again. So, and I think Jonathan and I were talking about how many thousands of pages he wrote just to get to what he did. I must have written 3,000 pages just to get down to the 350. So 10% success rate with the pages, but that's how it happened. And who knew?
So I wanted to ask each of you how you got your idea for this particular book. I know for myself, for my 3 books, I've always gotten the idea when I've been walking down the street, and I feel as if like a door opens in my mind, mm-hmm. and the book just comes into my head completely there with all the characters, so that one moment it wasn't there and the next moment it was there. So, Jonathan, how did you get the idea to write about Abraham Lincoln and his world?
Right, so my book, in a sentence, is Young Abraham Lincoln as told by his real-life best friend, a guy named Joshua Speed. And in real life, in the 1830s, the two of them shared a room, indeed shared a bed with each other in Springfield, Illinois, when Lincoln had just become a lawyer member of the bar, and Joshua Speed was the second son of a wealthy slave-owning Louisville, Kentucky family who had moved west to the frontier to seek his fortune. Chance threw them together, and they lived together for 4 years and remained lifelong friends. That's the real life story. That's the nonfiction part of the historical fiction. So back when I was having this sort of epiphany that I might not want to be a lawyer forever, it was an easy choice to think about writing historical fiction because I had always really enjoyed that. I enjoyed history. And they would say, write what you know. What I knew was being a lawyer. So that led me to legal historical fiction. And I was brainstorming one day with my sister, who's actually a real historian. She's the chair of the history department at the University of Pitt now. And I was brainstorming with her about historical lawyers who you could write a historical fiction series around, or a book around. Wasn't a series. Clarence Darrow, Socrates. I mean, I sort of was brainstorming all sorts of lawyers over history, and Abraham Lincoln was an obvious possibility. And my sister said, you should write it as told by his roommate, his real life roommate, who was Joshua Speed, who I had never heard of. And as soon as I looked into him, I had the idea of Lincoln and Speed as Holmes and Watson, because I had always loved the Holmes and Watson stories, and those are, of course, told by Watson as the first-person narrator, as sort of the best friend, roommate, and sparring partner of the great man, Holmes, who's out solving cases. And so I had sort of epiphany of Speed can be my Dr. Watson. He's the best friend, roommate, sparring partner of the great man and the narrator. So he's Watson is the first person narrator in the Sherlock Holmes books, Joshua Speed is my first person narrator. So I had this, my sister's suggestions sort of gave rise to this epiphany of the two main characters in the basic narrative structure. And that was the middle of August 2006. My book came out in the middle of August 2016. So it was 10 years from inspiration to publication.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Does your sister get 15% of all the money? She should really go after that.
No, she gets prominent acknowledgement.
So, Bola, was there a moment of inspiration for these particular characters in your book and this particular structure for your novel? Or was it a kind of continuation of some of the stories you had been writing before that you then shaped into this novel?
Right. No, it wasn't. So I lost my job in the recession in 2009. In December 2009, I lost my job. And I was looking for a new job. I was looking for a media company, and I was thinking about going back doing something similar, doing market research for another media company. I couldn't get a new job, and it was frustrating. So just like you said, I was walking down the street one day, and I got the idea. I was walking in front of the Time Warner building, not too far from here, and I noticed that there were chauffeurs waiting in front of the building, and waiting for executives, or at least they looked like they could be executives. I saw these men coming out of Time Warner, and they enter a car, and the chauffeurs drive them away. And I said, who has chauffeurs? Who are these people who have chauffeurs? What is it like to have a chauffeur? I mean, I'd like to have a chauffeur. It was very intriguing to me, because I come from a town where the people who have chauffeurs in my town growing up, but in America, I never met anybody who had a chauffeur. I mean, most of my friends in college were like similar backgrounds like me, working class or middle class. I never considered that you could have a chauffeur. But apparently the people who have chauffeurs in the Upper East Side. So I became very intrigued by the people who live in the Upper East Side who have chauffeurs. And the chauffeurs. So most of these chauffeurs, some of them look like they could be African immigrants like myself. And I saw these black men and I saw these white men enter it. And I thought about what it was like, these two men from very different worlds. What is it like being in the same car together? And because this was a recession, I was also curious about how the recession had affected each of them. So I went home, and the first thing I did was, you know, look up chauffeur job description, you know, what is it like? And I saw this job description, you know, chauffeur needed for a family in the Upper East Side. This is your duty, drive them from here to there, take them to the Hamptons, your summer vacation, whatever, take them to dinner parties, whatever. I hesitated, and then I saw the salary was about $35,000. So I said, huh, you know, so I'm going to write a story about a chauffeur, an immigrant, an African immigrant, working as a chauffeur for a wealthy Upper East Side family. And that is how I came up with it. And originally, like, you know, calling lots of us writers, it's a very small idea. I was just going to write about this man and the chauffeur for the most part, but it became a much bigger story. Their wives also became major characters in the story. And it became a very big story about, you know, not just the relationship between these two men from different backgrounds, but also about, you know, the immigrant little story, because the chauffeur is an immigrant, and also the American dream, because both sides of them are struggling with the American dream. But it was a very simple idea as far as, you know, something that the recession had affected my life. I'd lost my job, so I wanted to explore how the recession had affected the lives of other people in New York City.
So I think it's true for all of us here that taking this kernel of an idea and making it into a book is a process that took years and years and years, and far longer than any of us expected that first day when we got the idea. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how all of you kind of kept up your courage to get through to the end. You know, what's the day-to-day process like? And so we have many people in the audience, I'm sure, who are in the middle of books and struggling with books. And I see heads, you know, people nodding their heads. So how do you do it? What was your routine from day to day to keep you going?
You
want to
start with me?
Sure, I will. I'll tell you, what helped was when I'm walking down my walk that day, by the time I got to the stop sign, I knew what the last line of the book was. Mm-hmm. And that was an enormous gift. That was like, and in the end, it didn't turn out to be the last line of the book, but for 5 years, it was the last line of the book. I can tell the rest of that story later. But, and also, because my children were still pretty young then, it really focused my mind. I was like, okay, I've got 3 hours right now. And so I would sit down and write really hard until I would go pick them up. And often I would leave my house looking like, there's an expression in the South called, she looks like she's been dragged through a keyhole backwards. She looked really a mess. And I would go out of my house thinking, I have clothes on. What do people want? But it was helpful because when you have like the whole day, you can sort of it away doing things that you don't really need to do. So it really helped me. But the last, knowing what the last line was really helped me huge amounts. So.
So when I first took a leave of absence for my law firm, it was for a year, and I thought, notwithstanding the fact that I had written nothing in the previous 5 years, no problem, in a year I will write the book, I'll get it published, I'll get this out of my system, and then I'll go back to being a lawyer. And none of that happened. I wrote a book, and it was not close to, or I wrote a full manuscript, it was not close to being a publishable book. I did not get it published, and I did not go back to my law firm because it turned out that the writing process was much, much harder than I thought it was going to be, and also much more enjoyable than I thought it would be. But that whole first year of doing it, I was very conscious of the clock ticking. I had taken a year of leave of absence, mm-hmm. and 11 months and 30 days, I had 11 months and 29 days, and you know, as a lawyer, you keep track of your time. So I for 25 years, I was conditioned to, you know, keeping track of my time, and so I was very aware of the opportunity cost that was passing with every day that I did or did not make progress towards a published book. So that and 20 years of showing up working in a corporate law firm made me pretty disciplined about doing it.
Did you wear a suit every day when you wrote?
No, I enjoyed wearing shorts, and indeed the first couple months, I probably shouldn't admit this, the first couple months I didn't shave and barely bathe, so it was, yeah, exactly. I was trying to find myself as a writer.
You needed a glass of whiskey, right? So.
What about you, Bobo, the day-to-day sort of sometimes drudgery of
getting these books done. How did you deal with that over the years?
Well, somebody helped that I was unemployed. Not a good thing, but you know, when you don't have a job, you have a lot of time. Well, the thing is that I was, so I had this idea, right, to write this particular book, Behold the Dreamer, but I had spent 9 years on this other story, which I felt like I had to, like a story that I had to tell, because it's set in a fictional African country, and it's about like, you know, revolution and colonialism and all of that stuff that really matters to me. So I'm going to write a story about, you know, like living in an African country where you're being ruled by a dictator, which is kind of similar to my country. It's a wonderful country, but we've had the same president for since 1982. I wanted to write about things like that. So I kept on going back to the other story and kind of like rewriting, and then going back to the new story. So I was caught between these two stories. And then at one point, I just said that I need to focus on one story because it wasn't working. I needed to focus on something. And I was also doing 20 things, trying to get a new job, trying to do freelance work, trying, you know, many things were going on. And at one point, I tried to go back to work at one point, and the job didn't work out, and it was really hard for me, you know, just like, I need to go back to work, because I never thought about making writing a full-time thing. Maybe I never put my mind, I thought it would be cool, but I never went after it like that. I wanted to have a nice stable career and then write on the side. Then everything was falling apart. You know, I tried to go back to get a PhD, and that didn't work out either. So I said, no, let me just focus on this story for now, and even sometimes it doesn't work out, I always have, you know, hopefully I'll get into a PhD program, and then I always go back to my plan of writing on the side. So I said, let me just focus on this now. Again, I didn't have a job, so I kept on writing the story, and in 2013 was the year that I put a lot of work into it, and I said, I'm going to just rewrite it and revise it. I have no writing background whatsoever. I wasn't in a writer's group. I never took a writer's class or any kind of workshop. So I had to learn everything about writing by myself. So I had a challenge of teaching myself and writing the story. It was like learning on the job, which, you know, came with its own challenges. I read a few books on writing, but most of what I did was just being inspired by the books I love and the writers I love. So it was really, really hard, you know, teaching myself dialogue, teaching myself plot, you know, character development, all of that stuff, and doing that by trying to write this. And I wasn't aware how the publishing process worked, and it's not a good idea to try to query or do your work. It's really cool. So I kept on trying to get an agent, and I get 1 million rejections, and of course it was this up and down process. But eventually, I said, I'm going to focus on this story for now, and I did, and then I got an agent.
So I'm intrigued that you mentioned that you didn't show your work to anyone while you were working on it. I never show my work to anyone while it's in progress. But I know that some writers find writers' groups very helpful. And Jonathan, I know you've participated in a writers' group here. So could you tell us what you found helpful about it? Was it every month? I don't know how this works. So.
Right, and a number of the writers are in the audience. So what we did here was met once a month. There were, the numbers fluctuated, but there were about 12 people in the group, and we did 3 submissions per session. So we met for 2 hours. We spent 40 minutes on each submission, 3 over a 2-hour period, meeting every month, so that meant roughly every 3 or 4 months your work was up, mm-hmm. which was frankly good and not good. It was really great, especially when I was starting out, to spend time with people who were struggling with the same process that I was struggling with, even though the substance of what we were all writing was obviously very different. You know, from my perspective, one of the great things about working in the law firm is it's very collaborative. Big teams of people every day. I was, you know, interacting with all these other smart, talented people working on the same project I was. And as a writer, no one's working on the same project you are. So having the writing group as sort of a support system, and that was outstanding. And the people on the writing group were phenomenal. It was frankly less useful to the critical feedback on like the plot and sort of big picture things, just because you submitted 20 pages once every 4 months, and if you were writing faster than that, and I was, to my earlier comment, at least trying to write a lot faster than that, by the time submitted chapter one, and then I got comments back in chapter one. I was on chapter seven, and then the next time it turned to submit, I was on chapter 12, and I can either submit chapter two, which was way past where I was, or I can submit chapter 12, which wouldn't really make sense to people who had read chapters 2 to 11. So, it was something that, as a group, we talked about, and I think we sort of struggled with exactly how to match. I mean, if we had each been writing short stories so that what we submitted was self-contained, the form would have matched the substance a lot better. So I got great support and on things that were general things that you could sort of abstract away from. You know, I turned in a scene and I got feedback, when I write scenes like that, here's what's working, here's what's not working. It was incredibly useful for that.
It seems like the most useful part was being with friends who were facing the same problems, maybe getting their support.
Yeah, that was definitely, that was a lot of what I got out of it, for sure. Yeah. But as well as understanding what was interesting and what was not, what was working and what was not working. Alan Siegel, I could single out anyone, but Alan, who's in the second row there, who was one of my fellow writers, I remember turning in a scene, which I thought this was this great action-packed scene that was also basically nonfiction. It was basically a actual scene that had happened that I was adapting for my purposes, and I turned it in. I was all excited to get feedback. Alan was a tough grader, but I was hopeful he would like it. And he it was his turn to give feedback. He said, "This doesn't do much for me. What's going on here?" which was a great comment because it was interesting to me, and it was interesting to me partly because it was nonfiction, so it was interesting to me sort of from a historical perspective, but it wasn't servicing the plot the way that I wanted it to, or the way that I needed it to. And so there were great lessons like that I learned in the process of the writing group.
What about you, Julia? Did you show your manuscript to anyone for feedback while you were working on it?
I have a husband who's a writer, but he's a different kind of writer, and he doesn't like to read fiction. So he read the very first version, and he read the very last edit, and he didn't read anything in between. But he's a comedy writer, and I've had many women who interviewed me through this many, who said, "Does your husband write your jokes?" And I was like, "With your lady mouth, you ask me that question." And so off your question topic, the first time it happened, I was like, I think what you're trying to ask me is if it helps to be in a household where comedy is valued. So yes. And then the other two were written. And so I said, it's like when the prom queen and the prom king fall in love with each other because they're the most beautiful people they know. Now this makes it sound like I'm the most hilarious person in the world. Not that my husband is. But we love each other because we're funny. So no, we didn't write anything. But you know what was helpful to me, I was thinking about what you said before, is I read a biography of Richard Yates, who wrote Revolutionary Road, you guys probably know, and he taught me when I was young. I was like 21, I think. And when I read, this will make you laugh, because about that author thing, when he taught me, I thought he was well into his 70s. And so I'm reading this biography of him, and when he was 14, he decided he wanted to be a writer. So he typed the entire Great Gatsby, which I thought, that is such a good idea. I'm going to do something like that. So I took my favorite book and wrote down everything that happened on the page. And it really helped me internalize the rhythms of the book. But it's Bel Canto by Anne Paginon, if you guys ever read that. But it helped me figure it out. But the other great thing was, I thought he was so old when he taught me, and I was probably 51 or 52 when I read this book. And he was younger than I was at the time I was reading it. I was like, "Oh, living on cigarettes and whiskey, not so good for your complexion." So, yeah. But that's not what you asked me at all. It is.
So, the time comes, our 5 to 10 year time has passed, and you feel you've done all that you can do with the book. The question that I've asked more than any other question as a writer is, how'd you get your agent? So, how did you all get your agents?
Well, I stalk her. That's the best way to put it. I am I'm a big fan of Jonathan Franzen. I love the corrections a lot. Like back when it came out and it was, you know, big, I read it back then and I really loved it. And I mean, being I didn't know anybody in publishing, everything that I learned was on the internet, and one thing I read was that you should go after the agents who represent writers you like. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, I'm gonna go after all these political agents, which wasn't a good idea because a lot of them don't have time, you know, they don't take new clients, it's very hard to get their attention. But I did zero in on a few top agents that I really wanted, including Juno Diaz, the agent, who's a really big agent, and because I'm a fan of Juno Diaz also. So I first emailed my agent in 2011 with my old manuscript, actually, the story I was writing for 9 years. I first emailed her about that, and her assistant wrote back and said, oh, this looks interesting, she'll probably like to read it, and, you know, we'll get back to you. And of course, it doesn't work out like that, you know, if they don't get back to you immediately, because they have a lot of stuff to do. And so she didn't get back to me, so when I started writing my new novel, I wrote back and I said, oh, guess what, I have a new story now. Would you like to see this? And she's like, sure, we'll consider both of them. So I sent it, and they didn't read it still. So over the next 2 years, I kept on sending them new draft. Oh, I have a better draft. Oh, I have a better draft. Please read it now. And I mean, because I was going to other agents, there was one point when I got one agent who said, I want an exclusive. Which, you know, for people who query a lot, you know what an exclusive is, they say, you cannot show this to anybody else while I'm reading it. If I read it and I like it, then you have to sign up with me. So I said, oh my God, you know, like, this is a good agent, but I still have other agents who are my dream agents. So I told Susan's assistant that, like, can Susan please read this now? Because I want her to read it, but maybe to somebody else. And Susan read it and she rejected it. She said no. You know, and that was one of the worst days ever for me, because I spent so much time hoping and dreaming that this woman would represent me, and she read it. And she had, you know, her agent sent this. I remember it was March 31st, 2014. You know, I remember because, you know, yes, what a good day. The assistant said, Susan is going to get back to you by so and so day. And I said, please, I need a decision ASAP. She said, okay, March 31st. And I was sitting by the computer checking my email every 2 minutes, you know, and this is the day I get my agent. It's the day. And finally at 6 p.m. I see it. Dear Ingolo, I'm so sorry. I was like, oh God. And I couldn't get out of bed the next day. It was that depressing. Yes, it was depressing. I remember I went to the store the next day, I went to Whole Foods, I was crying my eyes out in the eye. Oh God, but I went back to work and then I rewrote it because her assistant really believed in it, and she thought that, like, I had potential, the story had potential. So I went back and I kept on writing it. And my thing was that Susan Golong, this really, really big agent, knows the name in Golongwe. I don't want her to forget my name. So I better get this stuff ready sooner than later and get it back to her. So I probably didn't eat or sleep for the next few months rewriting this. And finally, I had another agent who was also like, really, actually, when I sent it out again to a bunch of other agents, I got two agents agreed to represent me. And one of them was a really, really great agent also. She called me and she said, like, I really want to represent you. I think you have something special here. And I said, oh my God, I want you too, but Susan Golong, you know, I really like her also. I mean, so can you please, like, give me time to, like, you know, like, this business happens fast. I need to know. But she said, I know Susan Golong and I really like her, so, you know, write and tell her that I want you. She doesn't want you, I'm going to take you ASAP. So I wrote to Susan Golong and I said, this other agent really, really likes my work. Can you please read it ASAP? And poor Susan was at the conference and she was busy. How many people said, I'm going to read it ASAP. So she reads it and she emails me. This was July 24th. July 24th, 2014. And she emails me around 4 p.m. Can you talk for a few minutes? I'm like, yes, oh my God, she's calling me, she's calling me, and she calls me, and she goes, so Imbolo, thanks for sending it. I'm like, of course, just say it. Like, yeah, I see what you did. See, you know, very impressive. It still needs more work. I'm like, yes, I'll do anything. Just tell me what you want, I'll change the character's name, I'll change everything, just tell me. What does this mean? You want to reject me again or what? She said, no, I want to represent you. The happiest of my publishing life, you know. The rainbow literally came out that day. I mean, I went out and it was a rainbow, and I said, oh my God, this is special. but that is what happened, and after that, there were several rewrites, and she sold the book a couple of months later. So for me, my biggest thing was getting an agent. I know some people, it was more getting a publisher, but I think that, like, I kind of had an idea that this woman is the woman, like, I really, really respect the work she does, and I wanted to not only represent me, but also advise me on, like, you know, my career, because I didn't have any background, I didn't have other writers who could advise me, I knew nobody, so I wanted somebody who was in the field and who could say, this is your talent, and this is how, you know, this is, you know, the direction that you should go.
That's an amazing story. I've never heard anything like that.
Sorry, you're an agent. Remember how I said that Bel Canto was my favorite book? And I had a big advantage because I'd worked in the fiction department at Mademoiselle, so I knew, like, if a cover letter was good, you were so much more willing to read what was underneath the cover letter. And so I had applied to an artist colony, and I needed somebody to recommend me, and I had a teacher who taught me 25 years ago, and I said, can you just read this little chapter? Maybe, you know, like, totally, like, child about the whole thing. So I sent it, he said, okay. Sent it to him. He read it and he wrote me back and said, oh my God, Julie, it's better than Dickens. And so I was like, yeah. So my cover letter explained who I was and what my history was and what the book was. And then I said, what he had said, it's better than Dickens. And then I said, I don't know about that, but it's shorter. So she thought that was very funny. I wrote to this agent. And it was 11 o'clock at night, and the next morning when I was getting my children ready to go to school at 6 in the morning, some 7 hours after, I typed the N the first time for the first draft, and I looked up Ann Padgett's agent and written her a letter. So I look at my phone 7 hours later, and she's like, hey, I want to see your book. I was like, what? What just happened? Because I thought like months or years would pass if I ever heard from her at all. And so I sent it to her. Thursday and on Friday, Hurricane Sandy hit New York City, and people's houses are being washed out to sea, and they're dying. And I was like, but what if her iPad doesn't have any energy? Because it's all about me. And so then the following Wednesday, which was 8 days after I typed in the first time, she called me and said, I love your book. If you would have me, I would like to represent you. And I was like, yes! So it worked out. So, she sent it out the next day, maybe. It's crazy. But
it's amazing.
It was kind of a nice thing.
How about you, Jonathan?
I don't think anything so dramatic as those two stories. The very first version of the book that I finished, I sent around to a number of agents, a handful of agents. They all said no. One of them said, no, but I actually really like this idea. Young Lincoln is told by his best friend, Speed, give me a call if you want. And that was by far the best no that I had gotten. So I called him up and he said, really like the idea. You've got to start completely over again. Write a brand new story, start over again. You should use an outside editor to help you with it. I have some recommendations for you. And I did, and it's a long story after that, but that's how I first made the connection. So it was the best no that I got.
So we're getting a little short on time, and I want to leave time for questions, so I'm going to skip right to the publication date. So I usually think of fiction writers as people who are, you know, home alone, not answering the phone for hours at a time, and then your book is published, and suddenly there's this onslaught of touring and worrying about your rankings on Amazon, and Goodreads, and Facebook, and Twitter, and on and on and on, kind of the antithesis of what you do to be a fiction writer. And I'm just wondering how all of you reacted to that onslaught, and if you had to set up barriers against it, or if you embraced it. I know that some of you are still touring, and what that's like if you try to keep writing early in the morning before your plane flights and your appearances. So what have your lives been like since your books came out?
Can I start with this?
Yes.
I have a friend who's a wardrobe person in LA, and she used to do Beverly Hills 90210. And so when I sold my book, she sat me down, she said, okay, you've got to start wearing makeup. And for the love of God, get some decent clothes.
I just like Jonathan, as he's finished number two. Because if I had known now, before all the touring started, how all-encompassing it would be, I would have started the second one a lot sooner. So it's a little bit of a struggle.
Yeah, it is just like the question suggests, a completely different skill set, a completely different brain space to be in, to be promoting a book as opposed to writing a book. And there's no way I haven't found a way to satisfactorily do them at the same time. Certainly not at the same time, even the same day I struggle with. As it turned out, as Carolyn said, I sold the book, and I sold it as part of a multi-book deal, and it sort of coincidentally worked out that the second book was due to the publisher the exact same week the first book came out. So I was doing them simultaneously, and then as it's turned out, my revisions after I've gotten the notes back from my editor are due tomorrow. So I was at the hotel an hour before I came over here working on like the final two most problematic scenes of the second book. I'm going to go back after this and continue working on them. So there's no, I mean, it's on the one hand, it's a challenge and sort of a hassle. On the other hand, having spent 10 years trying to get to this point, it's a problem I'm delighted to have.
And how about you, Ebola? You've been doing a lot of touring.
Yeah, but to your question about the barrier, you know, I do have that. I have my wonderful marketing manager right here, and she's a barrier between me and the world. I'm not good on social media, all of that stuff, and the internet. So I basically just, the big difference that for me now is going out and doing events. You know, I'm not on social media. I don't read a lot of reviews. I don't do any of that. So this onslaught you're talking about, I don't know about it. There's a big wall, you know, between me and all that. And thankfully, I have a wonderful team that, like, the wall between me and everything on the other side. I think I need it for my own, you know, just my own space to be able to focus on my writing and the events. But I did have to do a lot of media, and that was another, like, it's another skill set. Answering these questions, and I enjoy it, and I didn't realize how much I enjoy doing events also. I love it. I don't know, maybe because I like to talk, you know, so it's like one more opportunity to talk. So that has been the biggest change for me, like, you know, getting dressed up, doing my hair, going out. I'm going to Texas next month. I'm mostly doing events in the area. Next year, I'm probably going to do a lot of, you know, overseas. Then it hasn't, I don't know, like, people say, how has your life changed? I mean, maybe because I'm very mindful that I need this space, you know, like, over there, there's the world and the opinions and what they think, and from what I hear, mostly positive, but I do need to have this space where I'm on this other side and I can just focus on my writing.
Well, thank you very much, three. Let's open the floor to questions. Yes?
For Jonathan, I'm interested in the relationship between research and writing. So how much time do you spend doing research versus writing, and was there any specific way you organized your research so it didn't become overwhelming and that enabled you to write better and to track it?
Right, so I did a lot of historical research for the book, both visiting, for example, modern day Springfield where the book is set, and walking around and trying to picture the way it would have looked in the 1830s. And I read a lot of travel journals. Travel journals turned out, from my perspective, to be the best thing, because it gave you, people were so interested in the frontier of the 1830s, and so, especially a lot of Europeans, sort of the reverse of the Grand Tour. The people in America were going to travel around the Grand Tour, in Europe, the Grand Tour, but the sort of the slumming version of the Grand Tour was to come to the American frontier and see all the crazy things that were going on there. So like de Tocqueville writing to Doctor of America is a French nobleman coming to America in the 1830s, traveling around, seeing what's happening in this new country, and writing it up. So there are a whole bunch of journals like that that I read and found. In terms of organizing, and I really didn't have a good system. Whenever I got a new source, I would read it and then just cannibalize whatever I thought was best for my story. So just as a, and it could be just the tiniest thing. So this next book that I'm writing is set on the Mississippi River. It's on a steamboat on the Mississippi River. And I tried to find all the journals I could, people steaming up and down the Mississippi River. And I read one in the middle of writing, and it was, you know, it's nothing that new, except it, at one point it had the phrase, "We passed by the rude riverbank." And I thought the word rude there is just perfect, because you don't ever think of it, but it sounds like sort of an old-fashioned word. It conjures up old-fashioned, you know, a description of an unimproved, scruffy riverbank on the Mississippi. And so from that travel journal, I took the word rude and figured out where in my manuscript I could have the description of rude riverbank. And that was the one word that I got from tracking down and finding that journal. And the other thing I would say is my struggle has been figuring out how to use the history in service of the story rather than instead of the story. In libel law, there's this thing, the truth is a defense, so if you say something bad about someone and it turns out to be true, you can't be sued over it. I always said in writing historical fiction, the truth is not a defense. That if something is true, but it doesn't serve the story, then you either need to take it out or you've got to change the history. Because what I'm doing as a historical novelist, you may have the same issue as a historical novelist, is not regurgitating the history, not being a history lesson, it's trying to tell a dramatic, gripping narrative story in a historical context.
Yes?
Just wondering, I was at your event yesterday at the, in Harlem, so this is a follow-up question. just wondering, did you need to travel to Cameroon to do a lot more of the aspects that have to do with the story in Cameroon, or did you rely on memory? And the second question I have is, would you consider this complete in terms of a story, or would you see angles that you could follow up on and sort of branch out into other sort of story ideas? Which means the question is, are you writing a second novel?
Thank you for coming twice. I had an event in Harlem last night. It was a great event. So I did not go to Cameroon. This was all based on like my childhood and the people I know growing up, like Jenny and many they are the Cameroonian immigrants. They were very much inspired by men and women I grew up around, and they, not only that, but also immigrants I knew in America, because most of the novel takes place in America, actually they all take place in America. So it was I wanted to like just, you know, the people I knew in Cameroon, including myself, like that desire to come to America, which is what the novel is about in a way, like this idea that when we come to America, we'll have this wonderful life. It was based on the people that have grown up around and how we all dreamed that, you know, when we come here, we'll live like the Cosbys, you know, because we thought, you know, life is like the Cosby Show, or like the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, or like Dynasty, or whatever American show we saw. So, and then when I came here, I saw that it wasn't quite like that. People don't have butlers, you know. I mean, not most people like this.
Oh, it's me.
So it was inspired also by, you know, even though the Cameroonian characters, they actually were inspired by lots of immigrants from across other different countries. And as far as the sequel, I get that question a lot. And it's a tough question because I don't even know, you know, say, I mean, should I write a sequel? I mean, do you think? I don't know. It makes me nervous to think about writing a sequel because the story was like Jonathan said, writing is so hard, you know. Like writing this novel was very, very hard for me. It was mentally, emotionally, everywhere. It was really, really hard for me, and I feel like I don't want to go back there. Like I've finished this journey, I don't want to go back there. So when people ask, "What are you working on next?" I start sweating. Like, I'm going to write another book. I mean, which is a wonderful thing that people want to read another book for me, but even if I were to write a book, I wouldn't say anything about it, probably, because I don't know how to talk about my writing until it's over. I'll probably tell my agent and make her swear not to tell anybody until the book is finished. But yeah, it's, I mean, my story, my first story about the fictional African country, you know, it's still in my computer, and I, you know, sometimes, you know, fantasize about going back to it and rewriting it. But I don't know, people like the idea of a sequel, and I feel like, should I write one just for the fans, or should I just, you know, not write it because it was a long journey and I don't want to go back there, and all the trauma of writing the story, I really want to revisit it. But I don't know, I'll keep you posted.
Any other questions? Well, thank you all very much for being here. There are books for sale outside. Everyone's books are for sale, and we'll all be here and very happy to sign any books that you might be able to buy. So thank you very much.
Thank you.